This is John McMurray of the Society for American Baseball Research, and I'm speaking today in Escondido, California, with Norman Macht, a longtime baseball historian who has completed three volumes on Connie Mack. We are speaking with Norman's and recording this interview with Norman's permission on July the 2nd, 2019. And Norman, I wonder if you could tell us, what got you interested in researching Connie Mack for as long as you did?
I met him briefly on a ball field in 1948, but without any intention of writing anything about him at the time. I was 18 years old, but he was there and I had an opportunity. So I said hello to him and asked him a couple of questions, and that was it. It was not a long interview, nor intended to be. But I noticed over the years that books about Babe Ruth kept coming out, about anything to do with New York kept coming out, the Yankees, history of the Yankees, Mickey Mantle, books of this kind, and never saw anything about Connie Mack. As a kid, I had a very slim biography of Mack that was published in 1944, written by Fred Lieb, but it was not a full-scale biography. It was a lot of it was based on interviews Lieb had done with Mack. And that was it. The 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, life goes on, and all these books are coming out, and nothing on Connie Mack. So I began to think, here is a person whose life, whose career, paralleled practically the history of modern baseball. Mm-hmm. And there must be a story there. He had great teams. He had lousy teams, but he also had tremendous teams. And gradually, I had written a book with Dick Bartel, the old-time New York Giants. And so I began to have a little more confidence that there should be something on Connie Mack. And nobody's doing it, so maybe I'll take a stab at it. So I contacted the University of Nebraska Press. At the time, their acquisitions editor was the publications editor of Sabre. He was a Sabre member. So I figured he's a logical guy to try. And he expressed interest in it. So it was going to be a normal size 300-page, one-volume biography, like most of them coming out were. So I started, and this was in 1985. And I'm living in Connecticut, and Connie Mack had been born and brought up nearby in Massachusetts, and had started his career in Connecticut. So I thought, well, I'm here. I can do the research firsthand on his early life. So armed with the contract from University of Nebraska Press, I started doing the research in the libraries and the old newspapers on microfilm. And I remember 1985, internet not invented yet as far as I was concerned. So you had to go to primary sources. I went to his hometown and they had a little museum, which was very helpful. His house was still standing. There were people who had made it their hobby, so to speak, to do some research on hometown hero. And so I began to get help from them and began amassing all this material and reading it from microfilm onto my tape recorder. And then I had to transcribe it all on my upright typewriter.
None of these computers,
none of that kind of stuff. And it began to take time. And then I stopped and I said to myself, I want to talk to as many people as I can who knew Connie Mack, who had played for him, or were family members. But remember, all of this had happened. 1950 was his last year managing. So I better start getting to them while they're still alive. So I stopped the research on Mac and began to devote myself to finding these people and getting to see them while I still could. And they, of course, were all over the place, the ones I could find. So I set out to interview them, traveled to Florida, found sports writers in Philadelphia and in Florida who had known him, got to interview them, found ball players who had played for him all over the place, got to interview them. They were all happy to talk about Mr. Mack. That was the only intro I needed. And they were everywhere, all the way from New England to California. And the Mack family was very cooperative. He had one daughter and a son still living. And the daughter at the time was in California. The son, Connie Mack Jr., was in Florida. So I didn't get out to California right away, but fortunately, I had a friend that I had done some writing work for who happened to live in the same town in California as Connie Mack's daughter. And she agreed to interview Ruth Mack, the daughter, for me. Years later, Ruth moved back to the Philadelphia area, so I got to know her and talk to her myself. But this took time and the travel, and so the other research was on hold, so I could get to all these people. And the oldest one I got to had been a bit player, but had been on the bench in the 1914 World Series. And I found him in New England and did get to talk to him. And he was still lucid, still with it. Remembered things I had no way of checking. So I accepted the stories he told me of what it was like to be on the bench. And when some words flew between Chief Bender and Connie Mack, and he remembered it all, and it was a terrific contribution to the book in that particular era that I couldn't have gotten anywhere else. So, and sometimes it was the children of guys who had played for Mack. Eddie Collins was long gone, but Eddie Collins Jr. was available. And Eddie Collins Jr. had a lot of his father's old newspaper columns he had written when he was a player, and he had his own memories as a kid of the A's. So that was a huge key. Those interviews with those players and family members. And you had to go into those interviews prepared. And preparation is the key, as far as I'm concerned, to a good interview. And I learned in doing these a whole lot about conducting interviews. And there was only one player who refused to talk to me.
Hank Majeski.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't know why, and when I mentioned it to some of his guys who played with him, they didn't understand it either, but I found him. I waited for him outside of his house because he wasn't home yet. And when he came home, I approached him in the driveway, told him why I was there, because mentioning Connie Mack was the key always to getting in and to be welcomed. And I don't want to talk about it, he says. And I said, well, all of your teammates that I've talked to so far, I've been very happy to talk about it. I certainly would like your memories of what he was like to play for. If you don't want to talk about yourself, that's okay, I can understand that. But whatever you remember about Mr. Mack, I would appreciate hearing. Nope. Mm-hmm. I don't want to talk. Okay. I didn't press it anymore. And so he was the only one that I didn't get to talk to. So then I started writing. And I'm writing. Connie Mack's upbringing, his youth. I had gone to the places, the shoe factories. Some of them were still standing. The fields where he had played, they took me and showed me. The house where he grew up, with the railroad track going right behind it. And the lake where he had played, and the firehouse that had the silver bat that his town team, that he was a catcher on, had won in the 1880s, I think it was. It was all there. And it was a tremendous resource for his childhood. The records of his school he had gone to, the classes, the number of students, what classes they took. It was a one-room schoolhouse. The behavior problems, all of this was in the town records. The Civil War records. His father had been in the Civil War. His father was away on duty when Connie Mack was born. All of this, the voting rolls records, the register of pets and animals, every household, how many dogs they had, how many horses they had, how many cows they had. It was all there. So it was a tremendous resource. And so I'm writing all this. And I get to what would be the equivalent of a 300-page book. And it included his minor league days. He broke in Connecticut. And all of his records and the newspapers are there on microfilm. And here I am. He hasn't even made it to the major leagues yet. And I've got 300 pages already. And this is supposed to be a 300-page biography of his entire life. So what do? I went to Nebraska Press, and I said, you tell me, what do? And they had their board meetings and got together because I had been told that a multi-volume biography is deadly. Nobody will touch it. They don't sell. They're money losers. No New York publisher will go near it. So Nebraska agreed when it was put to the bind I was in. So eventually, all of that became volume one, plus his early years in the major leagues, and it came out to be I got him sitting here with 600 and some pages, a real doorstopper. And this is volume one.
So as you saw all of this granular detail about how many chickens the families own and things like that, did you have a narrative in mind of, you know, what Connie Mack's life was going to mean? Were you thinking at this point, I'm going to compare him to McGraw? Are you thinking that because you said originally that the reason that you got into this was because his career had spanned kind of the life of baseball. But what was it that your research was uncovering that showed you something new about Connie Mack?
One thing I learned was, well, I didn't learn it so much as it turned out that his life was beginning to parallel the modern history of baseball. And I began to see the part that he played in it. So it became not just Connie Mack's story of his life, but the story of his involvement in the life of baseball, practically like a biography of baseball. Mm-hmm. And how the American League was formed. Because he was there, he was in Milwaukee when these meetings were taking place about starting a second major league and fighting the National League and, in a sense, invading and capturing players from the National League and the whole skullduggery involved in it. He and the owner of the Milwaukee team that he is now managing in the late 1890s, Army and Ban Johnson is there, and all of this intrigue is becoming part of this book. Mm-hmm. So suddenly it is not just Connie Mack. Mm-hmm. So it's beginning to swell. And how he goes to Philadelphia and gets backing from Ben Chibe, hooks up with a couple of newspaper guys who begin helping him finding a playing field. He has no players, and he's got so many months to get a playing field, make it suitable, expand some stands, and put together a team. And that's practically a book in itself, you could write. So, and then I get through all that, and then comes along the peace process. Mm-hmm. And all of the lawsuits because the National League and the Phillies sue him because of players jumping to the A's. And how is this going to be resolved? And he winds up losing Lajoie and losing Elmer Flick. And losing one of his pitchers, who goes back to the Phillies. And he's dealing with all of this. At the same time, he's got a manager team, which is a pretty full-time job in itself. And so it's swelling. And he wins a pennant in his second year. And John McGraw comes into it because John McGraw jumps the American League. He started out in 1901 in the American League, but 1902 now he jumps to the Giants. And he has nothing good to say about the American League and nothing good to say about the prospects of the A's. And here it is, 1905, they're meeting in the World Series. And just the stories of the World Series is a big chunk of a book. So it gets on, and Mac is building a team, and he's signing guys like Eddie Collins and Homer and Baker and these guys, and he's building this 1910-1914 dynasty. And they are such tremendous teams. And they deserve coverage. And all of the research is being done from primary sources. And even when the internet comes along, I find there's so much missing and so many mistakes that I made up my mind I'm sticking to primary sources. So I'm going to Pittsburgh, where he broke in as a manager, and using microfilm there. I'm going to Milwaukee, where he's a manager for 4 years, and doing research on microfilm there, and going out to his field there, and to the place where he lived, the hotel, which was still standing. And all that's taken time. And I wound up doing the whole book from primary sources. Uh-huh. And microfilm in Philadelphia and the Library of Congress and all those newspapers. And all this is taking years. Uh-huh. And at the same time, writing. And now he's finished with 1914. And the Federal League comes along, and the team falls apart, and it gets old. Some of those guys he started out with in 1901 are now getting old. So he isn't going to win anymore in the dead ball era. But I've got another 600-page book. And I'm in 1914. And the guy's got another 36 years to manage. And all kinds of things are going to happen in baseball. So I had to go back to Nebraska. And I said to him, what do I do? And he said, well, you're going to have to do some condensing. So I went back and started condensing, and I got through because now he's rebuilding and it's World War II, and that doesn't take a whole lot. But now he's starting to rebuild, and I had all that to cover, and we get to the 29, 30-31. Great team.
Great teams, yeah.
Great. Probably it rivals the 27 Yankees, 26, 27, 28 Yankees. And in some ways, in comparing it to, they're better. Mm-hmm. So somehow I managed to get that into that volume two. But here I am with everything else in this life. So I go back to Nebraska and I said, okay, this is what I've got. Do you want me to do it all the rest of his life in what could be a 800,000 page volume two, or can we have a volume three? And they said to me, he never had another winner. He had lousy teams in the 30s. Mm-hmm. He came close in 1 year, and he should have won it in 1948, which would have been miraculous because he's way over the hill as a manager. And then, excuse me, then there's a sale of the team, which whole books have been written about, the move to Kansas City. So I said, it's true, he didn't have any great teams. He never won another pennant. But there is all of this history of baseball that he's involved with. Things happen in the 30s. The farm system, mm-hmm. night baseball, coming of radio. And I said, all of these things were controversial. All of these things Mac was involved with. He's still a director. He's still on the board of the American League. He's still representing the A's in all their meetings. He and Tom Shive. He's still dealing with these things. And then there is the sale of the team. The 4 years when he has turned it over to his sons. And he has three sons active in it. And the only one who's competent is Connie Jr. And he has Roy and Earl from a first marriage who are considerably older than Connie Jr. and who are far less competent. And who's going to take over? And there's competition there, and he chooses the older ones, and it's a mistake. And they run into the ground. And those 4 years, they lose a tremendous amount of money. And there are negotiations, and they sell the team to a Philadelphia group. And I talked to couple of the guys who were in that group. So I had that story. And Roy Mack, who now is running things, because Earl Mack was a coach, but he didn't know anything about running a team. So Roy is it. And then there are meetings, American League meetings. And it takes several meetings over many, many months, wrangling over what to do with the team. Because they're divided. Connie Jr.'s out of it. But Earl and his father don't want to see the team move. And Roy wants to see it move. Mm-hmm. But what's going to happen in the family? It's going to tear it apart. And Connie Mack is getting old, and he can't take part in any negotiations anymore. So all of this wrangling is going on, and they managed to, there's a group of eight people in Philadelphia who want to buy a team and who pledge to keep it in Philadelphia and build another winner. And their offer is accepted by the A's. So, hooray, we've saved the team from Philadelphia. But there are forces at work within the American League, other American League clubs, who don't want it to stay in Philadelphia. And I fortunately got a hold of copies, got a hold of the minutes, the original minutes, of all of these American League meetings. And a tremendous source, primary source. And I got to sit, I couldn't borrow them, but I got to sit with a tape recorder and read them onto the tape recorder. And I could transcribe them. So now I've got the real stuff. And all of this is taking time. And all of this is taking words, writing. So I wound up, in the end, with another 600-page volume three. But it was complete.
Yes.
It's the whole story.
And as you look at it now, do you feel as that are there still aspects of Mac's life that you look at and are like, boy, I wish I could have put that in the book? Or do you feel you covered it?
No, I think I covered it. And if anybody else can come up with anything, more power to them. I don't mind if anybody researched. I found two mistakes, and they were not factual mistakes. And I'm happy to hear about it. If anybody wants to go through it, find any mistakes, by all means, let me know. I don't care. I'm not going to be offended. But they were mistakes of names. I got one, I can't remember now, but there was more than one. It was a front office somebody, and there was more than one with that last name who had been involved in baseball. And I picked the wrong first name.
Okay.
And that got pointed out to me. And the other was another, was a family member, a friend of Mac's. And I had known personally her grandson. And I mentioned them in the book. And I got a letter from a great-grandson of the person I had mentioned, who was a Philadelphia lawyer, who pointed out to me the mistaken, the first name of that Connie Mack friend from way back, from his family. And I told him, I wrote back and I said, I appreciate pointing it out. If there's ever a reprint. I sent the corrections on to Brown, Nebraska Press, and we'll correct it in the reprint. But other than that, I haven't done any mistakes or had any mistakes brought to my attention. I think, looking back, that particularly Volume 1, I probably, there's a tendency that a biographer has to fight, or any nonfiction writer, and that is, you have to fight the desire and the tendency to use every little factoid and every little something you come across in your research to get it in there, because you can overdo it. Mm-hmm. And I think, if anything, I overdid it in his early years. Too much detail. Mm-hmm. So if I were doing that over again, I would shorten that part of it. And I know there is that tendency and that desire to use everything you learn. And that's tough for a writer to overcome, but it is something that you should try to overcome.
But Volume 1 was roughly at least half to two-thirds of the time you put into onto Mac went into Volume 1.
It was the hardest to research,
yeah.
Partly because of the interviewing players, mm-hmm. and family members,
And not knowing where it's going,
and having to do everything on microfilm in all these different places. Mm-hmm. So yes, it took the most time to research.
One thing you have not mentioned so far is understanding Connie Mack's personality. And I'm sure that's something you drew out from the player interviews that you did, as opposed to in the vintage stories, because they didn't mention much about personality the way they do today. I wondered which players were the most important to you in understanding Mack the person.
I asked all of them, because in all my interviews I've done with players, and I've learned that you learn more about the stars and the Hall of Famers and managers from the people who played with and against them, or in the case of managers who played for them, than you ever learn by interviewing those managers and stars themselves. Uh-huh. So I always, whether it was related to Connie Mack or not, I would always ask players, I'm going to mention some names, uh-huh. and I don't want to hear from you anything about what kind of players they were. I only want to hear from you what do you remember about them as people? Mm-hmm. What were they like as people? And then I would mention the names and mention the manager's names. And a lot of times all you hear is, oh, he was a nice guy, period. Well, that's not very helpful. Yeah. But sometimes you'd hear, like when I would mention Ferris Fane, for example. Mm-hmm.
Who you did connect with on your...
Yeah, but I would ask other players, what do you remember about Ferris Fane? Oh, the fights. He would have fights on the field with players, with opposing players, with players on his own team, with strangers, and they would tell me some instances of some of the fights and things he went into. But that's just an example of what kind of people they were. Bobo Newsom played for the A's. So I would ask others, players, what was he like as a person, as a teammate? And they would have stories about Bobo. So that was a key question I would always ask. And it was very helpful. And I would ask them about Mr. Mack and about the coaches. Al Simmons, what was he like? What was he like as a coach? What was he like as a player? Eddie Collins as a coach. Earl Mack, what was he like? Connie Jr., who was involved in the business and coached for a little while, and he didn't like it because he took so much ribbing. He was a first base coach, and the fans would get on him and taunt him and give it to him. So he quit as a coach, but he worked in the front office and running the concessions and everything, and the players loved him. Well, I couldn't know that without asking the players. So that's how I would learn about the personalities.
If Connie Mack had been available for an interview, what would you have asked him, and what could he have filled in your book that others did not?
If I could have interviewed him, when?
Let's say if you could have interviewed him at the end of his, in 1950, right as his career was ending.
He would not have, I think, he would, from what people told me, who were with him then, his speaking pattern became halting. His memory was not there. I think he would have been a disappointing interviewee.
Let's say then that you could have interviewed him at the end of the 1931 season.
Oh, well, it's hard to say now because, or offhand, because I would have put a lot of time into developing the questions, because partly because I don't know how much time I would have had with him, and I'd have to go back today and revisit things happening then and revisit newspaper articles at the time to frame the questions I would ask. So I couldn't, I mean, it would take up the rest of our time not trying to think of putting together an interview then. So I don't think I could really tell you clearly what questions I would ask. That would take a lot of preparation.
Now, you have said to me previously that you felt that one should research baseball with the same rigor that we do other areas of history. And I wondered if you could expand a little bit upon that, and the approach that you have to researching baseball seems to me to be an academics approach, in a way, that you are, you know, you speak of things almost like a historian, primary sources, and, you know, trying to make sure you get, it seems that the object of a historian is to get it right, and that your first and objective in this book was to get it right.
The internet is, I mean, RetroSheet is a tremendous help when it came into existence, and in the last years I was working on it. That's a tremendous resource. Going back to old newspapers, and I think I mentioned in the preface or somewhere in the beginnings of the book, quoting what newspapers writers wrote in their interviews in ancient newspapers, I know that they were not necessarily verbatim quotes of Mack or players or anybody at the interview. I know that some writers made up things. I learned that. Some modern writers make up things. I know that. But where they are quotes from player interviews of the old days or Mack interviews, the gist of them, if it sounds like what the like accurate voices of the players of the time,
almost too good to be true, you mean?
if they sounded like, if they didn't sound like, I came to believe Connie Mack would say, if he wouldn't use those words or those phrases, I would not use those quotes. But if it sounded like what he would like, what he would say, based on reading so many quotes of his, I would use it. But I did put that precaution in the beginnings. Players in those early days, they didn't have tape recorders. They wrote what appeared in the papers or the articles from notes. And so what I'm quoting from them is not necessarily an accurate word-for-word quote of Mack. But if it was the gist of what was Mack's thinking, I would use them. And I asked some old writers, tell me, among the Philadelphia writers, fellow with Bob Paul, who was the sports editor of the Philadelphia Daily News for many years, knew Mack very well. Another fellow whose name I can't think of offhand was a writer in those times. I would ask them. I asked Shirley Povich, who was around then, what Philadelphia writers can I depend on being accurate in their stories and in their quotes of Mack, and which would you not put as much credence in what they wrote? And that was tremendously helpful to me, their answers. And I knew also that an early writer, Charlie Dryden, I think his name was, made up stories. I knew that from reading his stuff and then from talking to players. And this was one of his shticks. I mean, he was known, he was a humor writer, sports writer, and he made stuff up. But that was tremendous, tremendously helpful to me. And Shirley Povich told me how the sports writers approached their job in those days, and why they didn't write gossip, and they didn't write about the private lives of the players, or the off-the-field activities of the players. That wasn't what they were there for. And so things that the players got into trouble with, sometimes the writers knew about it, but didn't write it. And sometimes, he said, like Clark Griffith, if a player was doing things that he shouldn't have or got into trouble with something, Griffith might say, we don't want to hurt this fellow's family. So, yeah, we all, you know, we would say to the writers, we all know about these things. We know what this guy has been up to, but let's not write it about him. And they wouldn't. And they could trust the writers not to. So I learned from a lot from those writers as to who to trust and who not to. Very helpful.
Now, most writers couldn't take the time every time they write a biography to do everything from primary sources. What's the right balance?
As far as I'm concerned, there is no right balance. I don't trust anything that modern writers write in the blogs and all that stuff about things before their time, because they are using somebody else's writings. And I learned how does some things that aren't so, that never happened, get perpetuated. And the stories get perpetuated, I learned, because a writer today will see it in 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 earlier sources. So they say it must be true because it's in this book and this book and this book and this book. Mm-hmm. When what I learned was a writer might have seen it in one book or one source years ago, repeated it, and somebody now reads these two books and figure, well, it's in these two books, and one of the books was by Red Smith or some reputable writer, so I'm going to use it. So over the years, it appears now in multiple books, repeated. So writers of the 2000s, let's say, or even the 1990s, who were writing, who come along later and are writing on the internet and in the blogs and stuff, and see these multiple sources accepted as being fact, and they repeat it. And so I learned that that's how things get repeated, which may not necessarily be so, and I ain't going to use any of them.
Yeah.
So what today's writers do is up to them. Mm-hmm. But to me, the fact that something has appeared in 4, 5, 6 earlier books is not, doesn't make it so.
Now, Connie Mack's name, at least when I was growing up, was still part of the baseball conversation. It seemed as though, especially in the 70s and 80s, you heard a lot about Mack. You don't hear as much about Mack today, even though his relevance is, and his role in creating baseball as we know it, is still very much there. Why has Mack's name may have faded a bit with time, but it seems to be something more than that. That modern writers seem to focus on 1980 and present and have sort of forgotten about all the earlier things. Is that a fair assessment, and should Mack have more cultural currency than he does?
Well, he had none as far back as the 1980s. Which was when it occurred to me that there's tons and tons of books on everybody else in baseball, and there's nothing about Mack. Mm-hmm. And if there had been as many books on Mack as on McGraw, or there was a spate for a while of books on Christy Mathewson, and there was a ton of books on Ty Cobb, mm-hmm. and none on Mack. So he was not part of the conversation, let's say, in old timers, even back then.
But he was thought of as one of the elite managers. Like if someone said who were the top managers, he would certainly be mentioned.
Well,
even at that time.
For his longevity, certainly, as well as building what I still consider, and some others do too, the greatest team in baseball history. Now, there were later Yankee teams that some may argue about, but, I mean, a team that won 5 in a row, that's, you got to be doing something, doing 5 in a row. But his 29-31 has no parallels. And the 1910-1914 team was pretty well up there when you consider the personnel he put together. But his records, I mean, most wins by a manager ever is coupled with most losses by a manager.
Yes, that's right.
Because when you manage for all those years, you're gonna amass these numbers. But otherwise, he was not part of the conversation even back all those years ago.
Mm-hmm. I wondered, and I'm obviously one of